This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Before we get started, I want to remind people we're taping from my apartment at Bleecker Street near Bowery in Lower Manhattan, and I mention that because there's a really good chance there's going to be a lot of construction noise in the background. There almost always is. Random shouts and screaming, things like that. There's a Planned Parenthood around the corner, too, so there might be some explosions. You know, we'll play it by you. But today I'm talking with Coleman Hughes, who, despite being just a goddamned undergraduate at Columbia University, has already been published in places like the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, National Review, and Quillette. If that's not enough already, he's also a professional jazz musician who is a maestro, if that's the right term, with the trombone. But Coleman first came to my attention about a year ago when he started publishing pieces at Quillette, the Australian-based website that's been called the house organ of the intellectual dark web, a loosely affiliated group of people who challenge political correctness, social justice warriors, and arguments that they believe substitute emotion and politics for facts and independent analysis. His first piece for Quillette was titled Kanye West and the Future of Black Conservatism. It appeared after the rap star broke Twitter by saying that he loves the way Candace Owens, the controversial communications director at the pro-Trump student group Turning Point USA, thinks. Coleman's argument was, among other things, that many liberals, white and black, simply assume that blacks are always politically progressive and that that's just wrong. Since then, he's written a number of equally provocative pieces, including one called The Racism Treadmill, which wonders why progressives can't acknowledge progress on race issues. And another, just this past January, recalling Martin Luther King Jr.'s colorblind vision for a post-Civil War, civil rights America in the Wall Street Journal. At the end of February, he produced a video commentary for the New York Times about Bayard Rustin, the gay socialist activist who helped organize the 1963 March on Washington. In that video, Coleman notes that on many issues, including things like affirmative action and the policing of speech or of certain types of racist behavior like minstrel shows, Rustin would be at odds with contemporary progressives. Over the past year, Coleman Hughes has emerged not just as a wunderkind writer, but one of the most original voices discussing issues of race today. Welcome to Reason, Coleman.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. So, let me ask you this in the Bayard Rustin piece, and let's talk about that because it's recent and it's really good. But you can go to the New York Times website to the op-ed section and watch it if you're listening. But you called yourself a writer and a race commenter. And what do you mean by that?
I guess I called myself a race commentator because I comment on race issues, okay. I suppose. And I was trying to explain who I was in the op-ed and why I would care about Bayard Rustin, who's someone who also wrote about race issues. Race has been the topic that I've made my mark on thus far, so it's not...
And how old are you?
23 as of last Monday.
Okay, well, congratulations. Happy birthday. So you're just starting out, but you kind of write what you know, and I guess part of that is you know race, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Rustin first. What did you find most interesting about him?
Oh, well, what I found, I suppose his style of thinking about race issues was so principled. It departed from first principles in a way that you would not expect to see today, much less in 1950, 1960, 1970. And the range of issues on which he spoke his mind, whether it was economic policy, he was a socialist, whether it was affirmative action, which he opposed, reparations for slavery, which he opposed, free speech, which he was a stalwart defender of. You know, this is a person who was arrested 24 times in his life.
Yeah, and part of the video, you're at the whatever the big ionosphere, the map of the globe at in Flushing Meadows, right?
Yes.
At the site of the 1964 World's Fair, and you mentioned that he what did he get arrested for at the World's Fair in 1964?
I'm actually not sure. I mean, over the course of his life, he was arrested for everything from nonviolent protest to homosexual behavior.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he was arrested, I know, at various points for public sex and, you know, given the time and whatnot, you never know how exactly what that means. But Yeah, he was a pacifist mm-hmm. as well. I mean, he's mm-hmm. one of the reasons why the his part of the civil rights movement was committed to nonviolent resistance was because of him, really.
Yes, yeah. And when he met Martin Luther King, he has said, and I have no reason to doubt it, that Martin Luther King actually knew very little about nonviolence mm-hmm. at that point. And leaned on Rustin as a mentor
yeah.
in that respect.
He is fascinating. I mean, the documentary or the video op-ed has a bunch of footage of him, and he's an incredible presence. I mean, mm-hmm. He's kind of weird and offbeat, but yeah. he is really forceful in everything that he's saying.
Yeah, he is. And he had several public debates with Malcolm X in mm-hmm. the early 60s that were hotly anticipated.
Oh, God, yeah. So he, but, and you mentioned, and Coleman has a cough, so
yeah.
if we don't get the outside construction noise, we'll take it indoors and just have him cough a lot. It's fine. You know, as a socialist, I mean, basically what he said, and you have these clips in your piece, that it's not about, for him, it wasn't about race, ultimately. It was about social class, or economic class.
Right.
Well, explain what he was doing.
Yes and no. He was very clear that the moment where it makes sense to agitate on the basis of race is when one race is being denied, completely denied something that another race is not. So that is when it makes sense to protest. And that's why he was putting his body on the line throughout the 40s and 50s and early 60s so that Black people could get into a restaurant.
Right.
Because he would say, if... when it comes to public accommodations, restaurants, libraries, if you put your body on the line, eventually they will let you in. Now, once you have that, once you have the right to vote, for instance, then it no longer makes sense to protest because electoral politics is the lever that you now have to pull. And now we're talking about issues that affect Americans of all colors. We're talking about healthcare, talking about criminal justice, we're talking about economics. And the majority of Americans below the poverty line are white. So how are you going to talk about poverty in a raced way? It just made no sense mm-hmm. to him after about 1964. Hmm. And he was very clear about this.
Oh, and that's because the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights
that's
Act
right.
had taken place.
So his whole tune changed that year. And he wrote what is probably his most famous essay called From Protest to Politics. And I think it was not heated, but it was a very cogent point, I
right.
think.
How did he end up getting along with, you know, later radicals? Because, you know, one of the things that is kind of fascinating when you just start talking about the kind of architectonics of social change, there were the people like King and Rustin who were nonviolent. There were people like Malcolm X at various stages, either threatening or kind of openly kind of talking about violence. You had the Black Panthers later who were, a violent group. And it seems in a way that oftentimes you need all of that in order to actually get a society to move.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one point Rustin made, he was a very harsh critic of the Black Power movement and the Black Panthers. But one point he made is that Stokely Carmichael, Charles Hamilton, others of the Black Power movement so terrified white America that yeah. they actually sent many white Americans to Dr. King and Rustin
right.
and Roy Wilkins. So in that way, I suppose the best thing that can be said about you is that you're so terrifying that you sent Americans yeah. to the right part of the movement. It's a bit of a backhanded compliment, but it's still part of the story of progress, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you want people who are a little bit crazy and then people you can work with,
yeah.
Or something like that.
And, right.
Do you have a pantheon of history of figures? I mean, Rustin is obviously in there and I suspect Martin Luther King is. Are there earlier civil rights figures that you are particularly fond of or that resonate with you?
I suppose A. Philip Randolph.
Mm-hmm.
He was Rustin's mentor, the person Rustin admired most in the world.
Yeah.
And he was also a socialist, arguably an atheist mm-hmm. as well.
Which is also kind of fascinating because the civil yeah. rights movement, and certainly through King, but also in another way through a variety of Black or Nation of Islam characters, there's a huge religious streak in it. And somebody like Frederick Douglass was, mm-hmm. I guess there's some debate as to whether or not he was using Christian kind of, or Bible, the Bible rhetorically or out of a true sense of faith. But
yeah,
it's odd when you
with
start
Dr. King,
about,
I think there's no doubt.
Oh, yeah, he, yeah, of course. Yeah. Not. Yeah.
But one thing I did learn that was interesting with Rustin is that Rustin, when he first met Dr. King, he's the one who urged King to start an organization. And King asked Rustin, can you draw up the plans? And Rustin drew up the plans for something called the Southern Leadership Conference. No Christian.
Right.
And then Dr. King added the Christian element,
yeah,
which I think
yeah
is very interesting because
yeah
Rustin was a Quaker.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know much about Quakerism, but you never really heard Rustin invoke God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Quakers are kind of Gnostic, where, I mean, they are a Christian sect. They grew out of the English kind of collapse of established religion in the 17th century, but they were pacifists, certainly. And they also became early abolitionists in the United States after going through a period where they actually owned slaves. But then, yet it's odd because the Quakers are now seen as, you know, not quite Unitarian, but they're kind of like, you know, a feat on some mm-hmm level. But back in the day, they would travel from Pennsylvania because William Penn was, they would go to New England where there were theocracies and they would just stand there and they wouldn't say anything, but they would piss off the Congregationalists so much that they would have their ears and noses cut off and have hot rings put through their tongues. Wow. I mean, they were real badasses.
Yeah. Nowadays, you just think of Quakers as like sitting in silence. And
yeah. Yeah.
Whoever wants
and,
to speak,
and they're
speaks
always anti-war. That's like,
yes,
you know, all of the...
And Rustin yeah was arrested for conscientious objection to World War II.
Yeah, which is amazing. And it's, you know, it's a really interesting topic that I've seen in a couple, discussed in a couple of places of Black attitudes, African-American attitudes towards World War II, mm, which is, it's much more ambivalent because it's kind of like, you know, you're in a, you know, freaking segregated society, and then you're being asked to go kill other people for, mm-hmm, you know. What about his socialism, though? I mean, at the end or towards later in his life, he started, you know, and this comes up in your piece, Rustin is talking about, you know, not affirmative action, not reparations, not anything that is race-based, but he did want things like a guaranteed job, a minimum wage, nationalized health care. Are those compelling to you, or you know, I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, where are your politics in terms of economics or that kind of stuff as opposed to race?
No, healthcare is something that I'm too ignorant to comment on, but with regard
you
to
should, you know, at, especially at the beginning of your career, you should never feel too ignorant to comment on anything.
It's something I'm learning more about. But minimum wage, I tend to take the line that it's clearly a trade-off, not mm-hmm just a win for low-income
right
people. If you I'm not the first to point out, Thomas Sowell and Walter mm-hmm Williams have been talking about this for decades, that the yeah unemployment rate for Black teens was virtually identical, sometimes better than that for
right
white teens until the late 40s, early 50s, when racism was much worse.
Mm-hmm.
Now we view the problem of Black teenage unemployment as a chronic problem, a part of the, quote, legacy of slavery, as if it's not a problem of the past 50 years.
Right.
And obviously, it's a problem that rose up in proportion to the successive minimum wage hikes that price especially low-skilled
right
entry workers out of a job. So I think, obviously, if you could solve poverty by raising the minimum wage, the whole world would just raise the minimum wage to
right
$50 an hour. It's naive. Not to say that there's never a reason to do mm-hmm that. There could be in terms of if there's monospony issues.
Right.
Well,
and this
one of the
Quillette pieces that you read, I was looking through as I was preparing for this. You reviewed economist Tyler Cowen's book, Stubborn Attachments.
Which is quite good,
Tyler
yeah
is a friend. I talked with him about that book just a couple months ago, where he argues that, you know, the best thing a society can do is to maximize long-term sustainable economic growth, and also making some bets against catastrophic climate change down the road, or, you know, we owe the future some measure of respect and maintaining human rights and pluralism. Do you find that vision compelling?
Yeah, I find that vision very compelling, and I find it more compelling than Rustin's socialist mm-hmm vision. I think generally that vision is underrated,
mm-hmm,
especially among thinking people my age, I find it's more fashionable to take the line that capitalism is the source of our problems. And I think any fair look at the history of wealth creation around the world would credit free markets with the bulk of the reason why we have wealth to begin with.
Why do you think that is fading? If it is, you know, one of the reasons Tyler talks about writing that book is that we need to recommit to kind of basic ideas. Like we've lost the kind of narrative of how societies grow or get wealthier or improve their quality of life. Why do you think it's, you know, it's very common among younger people, millennials and Gen Z people, to be kind of, if not outright hostile to capitalism, not to kind of be embracing it? Where is that coming from?
Well, I think it requires a little bit more intellectual labor to understand why capitalism is a net good than to believe that it's a net evil. If you just extend the analogy of the family to society and you look at how big businesses seem to behave, they seem to be so selfish, obviously not more selfish than the rest of us,
right?
But it takes work to understand that wealth isn't zero sum, that Jeff Bezos getting wealthy isn't coming at my expense.
Well, and also, so like there's the zero sum game where it's like if he's got $1 billion and I've got 50, it's because he has it all the money or something. But at the same time, I think about this of like Amazon, and I can remember a pre-Amazon world, and I was living in a small town in the Midwest, and it was like you couldn't get a bunch of stuff, you know, and then suddenly you know, stuff was being delivered to you in a couple of days and then, you know, overnight and whatnot, and books and clothes and food and all of that. Is part of it that, I mean, you grew up in a world where like everything is on demand. Mm. I mean, it's actually a pretty good world, right?
No, yeah, it's quite good.
Everybody has a cell phone. I mean, a cell phone used to be, first off, it didn't exist, then it was rare and super expensive, and now everybody has a cell phone. Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's taking for granted the level of wealth that society now has, so that you don't become curious about the process by which society attained that much wealth. I don't know really of a society in history that became wealthy by fiat, really.
Right.
Or if it was by fiat, it was by state capitalism of the East Asian style.
Right.
And I don't, that's not sufficiently understood, not sufficiently talked about outside of econ classes, I would say.
Do you feel a lot of people would say that, you know, the education system, K through 12, but especially at colleges, and you're going to Columbia, is very left wing. And so that you're always hearing a story, you know, the story that is told is not one that capitalism or markets and kind of individual innovation and freedom come up with new and better ways of doing things, but rather it's this, you know, it's more of a kind of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez narrative that if people have more than you, it's because they're exploiting you. Was that your experience?
It completely depends on the apartment, from the department rather. Econ departments, even Paul Krugman's econ textbook, which I'm now using in an econ class, teaches you the principles of economics. You will learn that the minimum wage can and often does have the effect of reducing employment, right? Like these are economic principles. Economics is a science, and it still is a science. It's not a perfect science.
It strives to be a science.
Yeah. It's responsive to reality testing.
Yeah.
And so, I wouldn't worry too much about that. It's these other departments which are much more wishy-washy, much less responsive to empirical data, sociology, American studies, even history to a degree, political science, gender studies, ethnic studies, African American studies,
and Rustin was against ethnic studies.
He was against the establishment of African American studies departments when students were marching into university right. president's offices and demanding them in the
late
60s.
What was his beef with that?
Well, his beef was that African-American history is American history. And for so long, white supremacists have been arguing that we ought to separate ourselves intellectually, artistically, culturally. And in a perverse way, the creation of African-American studies as if it were a unique discipline, as if it were separate from the study of America and the study of humanity, is in a bizarre way an admission that the white supremacists were right to say that we should be separate.
And of course, this, you get that. I mean, these are arguments about integration and segregation. And there's, you know, Malcolm X certainly at a certain point in his life was very much of the segregationist. And, you know, when Nation of Islam and the Ku Klux Klan kind of start to have a similar policy agenda, it's time to probably rethink things.
Right. And his other concern was that the standards within African American studies departments would lag because it would be more of a factory for activists than a factory for the intellect. So you might, you know, I think he said something along the lines of, we're sending students in there to study themselves in this kind of soul studies way rather than learning to think rigorously.
Yeah.
And
did he go to college? Do you know?
I should know that.
I'm always impressed by, you know, like people who, I mean, and obviously going to college doesn't mean you're going to come up with good arguments, but it's you know, the intellectual genealogy.
I think he did go to college. Yeah. I'm not sure if he finished.
You are a philosophy major?
Yes. And
where does philosophy fit into, do you think is it teaching you to be rigorous or is it more kind of politically motivated?
My interest in philosophy was never politically motivated. I guess I got into philosophy via the philosophy of mind and ethics, which I thought were very interesting topics and still do.
So what does that mean? Like who do you study? Who's your A number one philosopher at the moment?
I don't have an A number one philosopher, but the way I got into it was books like Consciousness Explained by Daniel Dennett, books like The Moral Landscape by Sam Harris, popular philosophers who spoke about consciousness, the human mind.
You know that way madness lies, though. I mean, once you start reading Daniel Dennett, it's like it's really hard to... There's a lot of places where you can really go off the deep end, I think.
Yeah, he's a very brilliant writer.
Yeah, absolutely.
I got into politics only after that, I would say.
How did you... what do you mean that you got into politics?
Well, I guess I was a senior in high school when Black Lives Matter really ballooned, and I was kind of paying attention on the periphery. You couldn't not be, to an extent at least. And this is right around the time when I didn't really know what I believed necessarily politically. I didn't have a strong... I had SJW tendencies, I would say, in the sense that I...
Do you had to go to conversion therapy for that or something?
Well, I actually did go to... I went to a conference in high school where we learned the tenets of intersectionality, critical race theory, essentially. I didn't know that that's what it was, but I found these ideas more or less compelling. I remember coming back and giving a speech to my high school about the concept of internalized oppression, which is that, you know, people of color can't even escape the oppressiveness of society, even in the comfort of their own mind.
Do you agree with that or some version of it? I mean, this is an argument that's been, you know, in kind of modern or contemporary terms around for at least over 100 years. But there's a certain logic to it, right?
What's the logic to it?
Well, you know, the idea that that oppression or that social relations are, you know, are replicated or inculcated into individuals, so that even in your resting moment, you might have absorbed a vision of social relations that puts you in a particular relationship to people around you, and it could be good or bad. You know,
I think the best version of that argument is that the human mind is a pattern-seeking machine, and it. If you're a Black person who is noticing that Black people in society occupy, on average, a lower status, that's a pattern or a heuristic that your brain will form. And when you look in the mirror, that pattern will be operative. So that, I mean, that's something I view as certainly unfortunate. If I were God creating the universe, I would not create it that way.
Or you get rid of mirrors, right?
Whatever. Or you, but that shouldn't be overstated. If we're going to talk about self-esteem, no race is going to, it's never going to be the case that your race precludes the possibility of your having low self-esteem. White people are more likely to kill themselves than black people in this country. You know, the number one suicidal demographic is middle-aged white men.
Oh, man. Tell me about it.
So
that's a different podcast, but
yeah. So, I mean, so we shouldn't overstate
right.
the degree to which that is a driving factor behind behavior.
What kind of high school did you go to? You grew up in New Jersey, the greatest state in the union.
Thank you.
Probably in all of North America, actually. We'll even throw in those Canadian provinces. What kind of school did you go to?
K through five, I went to public school in Montclair, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Six through the end of high school, I went to a private school called Newark Academy in Livingston, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. And what was Newark Academy like? Does it have a particular educational mission or something?
Small private school, not religious, very high standards, known for its good academics, for getting kids into Ivy League schools.
Yeah. So it worked for you.
Yeah.
What do your parents do?
My dad is in finance, but was on the legal end of finance for most of his life. My mom is deceased, but she was in marketing for a while, but around the time of my birth switched to getting a PhD in anthropology and was a quasi-Marxist. And so I knew the name Marx and Durkheim when I was 5 years old, because she would talk about them constantly to me.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
Two older sisters.
Yeah. And I mean, it sounds like you were in a family that was pretty aspirational or achievement oriented.
Treatment oriented?
Achievement oriented.
Yes. My mother was, education was her ticket out of the South Bronx, and she carried that with her. So she was very dogged in pursuing education for her kids.
Do you see, and I want to get back to a couple of the pieces that you've written over the past year, you know, in your own life, do you see class as a more meaningful category of kind of conceptualization than race? Or how does this, and you mentioned intersectionality. I mean, one of the things, and I guess it was... Colin Powell at one point had said sometime in the recent memory, but he said that, you know, if you're a black man in America, however you think of yourself, you are seen as a black man, and that carries with it certain types of, characteristics. But I mean, do you see yourself in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of gender, all of these things, or how do you apportion that out?
I mean, these are all facts about me.
Yeah.
I think that what you're getting at is which axis has been most operative in my life. I mean, it's clear to me that class has been more operative in terms of determining the kind of people I'm around, the kind of peer groups that I'm being influenced by, than race. It's not to say I've been treated exactly the way that I've experienced racist incidents in my life. I've been in rooms where, you know, I've noticed that, or I've certainly suspected that I'm being treated somewhat differently than I would. I'm sure that if you had a perfect window into my own mind, that I don't treat people exactly the same, although I strive to, by race. So I'm not claiming to be immune from bias. I think that'd be ridiculous. But class is clearly the more fundamental factor in my own life.
One of the recent Quillette column that you wrote was about a campus incident at Columbia where a drunk white kid was filmed saying that he loved himself and he loved white people and that white people created civilization. Talk about your reaction to that incident and what we should take away from that kind of thing.
Well, the first thing I thought is that I've heard celebrated black activists say nearly identical statements, substituting the word white for black. So Alicia Garza, one of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matter, has said, and I'm almost quoting for verbatim, without black women, there would be no civilization of which to speak. DeRay McKesson, who is essentially the poster boy for Black Lives Matter, you know, every other week on Twitter, he posts, "I love my blackness and yours." These are almost word for word what Julian von Abele, the drunk kid, said about white people.
Well, he was really not, even that name is like a kind of nightmare.
Yeah, it just brings to mind like German scientists, right? But he got banned from Barnard's campus for saying that. And we celebrate black activists who say very similar things.
But isn't it different to say, like, if you're, you know, if you're representing, and I guess you're arguing no, but if you're representing a group that has been, you know, for a long time has been minimized as, you know, not contributing anything to civilization or society, should that be treated the same thing as, you know, a drunk white kid saying something?
It depends what your view of racial ethics is. If you get your racial, if you take the view, which many people do, that the meaning of race and the meaning of racism is given by the particular history mm-hmm. of a particular society, so that there is no symmetry between white racism and black racism, because there has historically been no, there's been no symmetry in the power relations right. between racism, between races in this country. It's been white suppressing blacks. Therefore, it is not the same when Julian von Abele right. says, "I love white people," when DeRay, as when DeRay says, "I love black people." If you take that view, that's fine. I don't take that view.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King said black supremacy is as dangerous as white supremacy. If you, I take the view that racism ultimately is a departure from reason. It's a departure from the neutral treatment of human beings. So I don't see a difference because there's obviously a historical difference, but ethically, I don't base my ethics in the contingent history of a particular country, but in principles that transcend the particular history of America.
You wrote in, I guess this was for the Wall Street Journal, a piece about around King's birthday about his colorblind legacy. Discuss that a little bit. And, you know, I understand and I think it's clear why that's appealing to you. I think it's appealing to many people. Do you feel like we're further away from that than we were even, you know, by the time he was assassinated?
Yeah, I think the quickest way to show that you're not in the know, that you're not woke, that you don't really understand the history of racism, is to invoke colorblind or post-racial language.
Right.
We saw this with Howard Schultz a few weeks ago, who said, "I don't see color," which actually on its face is a ridiculous thing to say, because you do. Even right. people who are literally colorblind
right.
can yeah. distinguish between blacks and whites. But let's give the man a little more credit. He's a CEO of Starbucks. He's probably not saying that he literally
of course,
has
yeah.
no cones and rods in his eyes.
Yeah.
He's saying he strives to treat people as if he didn't see color.
Right. And a lot of people, as you're saying now, are saying that's a problematic viewpoint, right? Yeah. Because we should always be trying to redress past injustice.
Bernie Sanders a couple of weeks ago said we should not be looking at politicians based on the color of their skin, but on the content of their policies.
Mm-hmm.
Verbatim what Martin Luther King said, not just about people, but King said this about politicians too. And Colbert the next night just mocks him.
Hmm.
Mocks him for saying this.
Yeah. So what's driving that? Because in many ways you know, and at Reason, we write a lot about criminal justice issues, and there's no I don't think there's any question that, for instance, the effects of the war on drugs, whether it was designed this way or not, is open to some debate. But it has been impacting black communities much more dangerously or badly than white communities. There are forms of kind of systemic either racism or effects on things like that. But on another level, in a more profound way, you know, everything is getting better for everybody. So why, if we're actually getting closer to something like a post-racial society or one where race does not dictate where you end up, what explains, you know, the resurgence in a belief that this we're in a uniquely racist moment in American history?
Well, I would say the framing of the question assumes that activism is a function of the objective level of grievance in society, or the objective levels of grievance in history, which it's not. In my view, it's mainly a function of the power of ideas. And there's an idea right now, which I would call the anti-racist vision, which I explained somewhat already, but it's the idea that the meaning of race, the meaning of skin color, skin color is not meaningless.
Right.
It's not meaningful in the way racists think, in the sense that God created a hierarchy, but it's meaningful in the sense that it has been injected with meaning by history.
Right.
And you cannot erase that.
Right.
Because of the specific power relations of American history, it means something to be black and it means something to be white, and they're not symmetrical.
Right.
So to talk about colorblindness is to traffic in this naive notion of we're going to fire the starting gun right now and say that everything's fair, but it hasn't been fair for hundreds of years, so how dare you? That's the view.
Right.
My problem with that view is that the very reason we had grievances, the very reason we have these historical injustices to point to, is because we did not obey the colorblind ethic in the past. So it's circular, in my view, and perverse to use those historical injustices, those failures to obey the colorblind ethic, as a rationale to never have a colorblind ideal in practice.
Well, and in the book, the article, The Racism Treadmill, you ask, why can't people acknowledge progress in kind of racial issues? And is it that they don't want to because that threatens their sense of identity or their position, their power in a given moment?
That could have something to do with
it. Yeah. I mean, is it that, you know, they're saying no, you know, I if you look at polls, and this, you know, is kind of fascinating, and I don't think anybody was really anticipating this, but after Barack Obama was elected, that race relations got worse, according to, in places like Gallup and Pew, and they would, you know, people, it, you know, it, it's odd. It's like,
I think,
you know,
that's correlation without causation, though.
Okay,
I think that,
okay,
that was probably a function of social media, because now you could see videos of black unarmed people getting shot by the cops. And in isolation of the fact that in raw terms, in raw numbers, more whites get killed that way than blacks, that evokes all of the outrage. It invokes the memory of Rodney King and Emmett Till.
Yeah.
And it is so ripe for misinterpretation into a grand narrative of it's open season on black men.
So that it's not the facts on the ground, but it's the way that we represent things and then have conversations based on, not that these events don't happen, but that they're not really representative of where we are as a society.
Yeah, I mean, police shootings had been going down for decades.
Yeah.
For decades before Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson.
Yeah. So do you worry at all about Trump? You know, in this, I was looking at a Gallup poll. And currently, in their most recent numbers, only 18% of blacks are satisfied with the way blacks are treated in this country, compared to 51% of whites who say they're satisfied with the way black people are treated in this country. Is it important to close that gap? And if so, what are some of the things that might?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the perception is so out of touch with the reality, but the perception matters in itself. So I think what happens is there's something called the optimism gap, which people like Steven Pinker often talk about, which is most black people judge their own lives vis-a-vis racism to be okay. And this is reflected in Gallup polls as well. Some 60% of black people will say bias is not the main issue they face in housing, jobs, income, etc. But the sense is that other black people are suffering from this. I'm okay, but my neighbor is not.
And I've seen actually data or polling that suggests that white liberals in particular feel that way, or that they have an over, they oftentimes will poll higher in saying that racism is the big thing for blacks.
That's right. The Pew poll from 2016 or 17 showed 79% of white Democrats saying that racial discrimination is the main thing keeping blacks down,
which was
19 points higher than for black people themselves. Yeah.
How do you begin to address that? Because this is it's a series of misperceptions then, or differing perceptions. What are ways to kind of change the conversation so that we're not trapped in a world where we can't even talk about these things is to kind of be part of the problem?
Well, I think the media has a responsibility, and critics of the media have a responsibility to call them out when they present stories that need not be racialized in a racial manner. Every time a black person gets killed by a white cop, the headline reads, "White cop kills black, unarmed black suspect." Or, we are very quick to assume, as Sean King did a few months ago, when a black person is killed by a white person, that it's a hate crime, right? The little girl who was killed, I believe, in Texas in January, Sean King, we had no idea who the suspect was. We had a vague idea, a vague sketch. And within a few days, Sean King raised almost $100,000 on the assumption that it was a hate crime. Turned out to be just another black on black homicide, a gang shooting, and a little girl gets caught in the crossfire. Happens all the time. But there was such a hunger for the narrative that it was a hate crime, that people were just willing to throw their money at it. And I think there's a hunger for that narrative right now, that black people are oppressed. And there is a kind of mass confirmation bias that's going on in the media. We saw it with Jussie Smollett as well, a lack of critical reporting, a lack of skepticism about an event that is presumed to be racist, because we live in a kind of era of McCarthyism with regard to race, where it's assumed that where there is smoke, there is fire. And where there is nothing, there is smoke. So,
yeah, and I guess with Covington Catholic kids, that whole thing at the Lincoln Memorial, which it wasn't black and white, it was American Indian versus white kids, was originally read very much through a kind of race or ethnic lens, and kind of got changed as more context became available. Do you think, is blackness distinct in when we talk about America and we talk about American identity? Is it fundamentally different than, say, other ethnicities like being Latino, or gender discussions about sexism or about sexual orientation? Is blackness, something that is absolutely different the way that it's played out historically?
What do you mean by that?
Some people and early, early discussions of things like affirmative action programs in the 60s and early 70s would sometimes people would say the history of blacks in America because of slavery and because of certain types of discrimination and segregation is fundamentally different than, say, whatever Jews or Italians or Irish or Latinos currently face. And then this gets into a question about intersectionality, where you were talking about earlier, about where there are different levels of, or different types of oppression or privilege. And is blackness something totally different? I mean, is it operating on a different system?
I don't see why it would. Many people believe that it does. And I think if you tell yourself that enough times, it can, in a way, come to be true. Because, ultimately, I think this is much more about the power of ideas than it is a response to objective conditions. What I mean by that is that the idea that blackness is fundamentally distinct, that the history, the brutality against blacks is in this country has been so unique, so that it's absolutely invalid to compare blacks to any other ethnic group, because the history is that potent, that black people get up every day with the weight of history on their shoulders. I don't see why this would be true with, why would it be the case that one faction of human beings from West Africa taken at a particular time are so fundamentally different from every other ethnic group in history that history seems to weigh on their shoulders more deeply than it does for every other ethnic group that has been enslaved for the past 10,000 years.
Right. And I guess you've mentioned Thomas Sowell before in a variety of his writings. He's also talked about how many of the kind of demographic patterns or behavioral patterns that people, not just about blacks, but we ascribe to particular ethnic groups, you know, when we say, oh, well, they brought this over from the old country or whatever, and in fact are like really relatively recent. So that black illegitimacy rates or illegitimate birth rates were much lower at much higher rate when racism was much higher, et cetera.
Yes. Or, you know, although so I've heard that stat challenged by Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson,
yeah,
who also he wrote a sweeping study of slavery called Slavery and Social Death, and he observes right at the beginning that there is, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something like, there's probably no population of human beings that has not at one point been either slaves or slaveholders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he observes that it's what's peculiar is that we called slavery the peculiar institution. There's nothing peculiar about it.
Right.
It's been practiced in virtually every civilization for the past 10,000 years.
Put on your philosophy of consciousness hat for a little bit. How does, you know, and you touched on this, racism, discussions of race and of large categories, it's kind of collective identity and whatnot. What is the role of individualism and of thinking yourself as an individual as opposed to a member of a larger group? How does that fit into your thinking? And is that a way to perhaps change some of the conversations that we have about group-based identities?
Mm. Well, I guess I would say individualism is most useful when thinking about ethics and thinking about the law. There's this idea of what Thomas Sowell would call cosmic justice, what you might think of as group-based justice for abstract, historical, intertemporal groups, which says that what we can do with policy today, think of affirmative action, is to balance the scales of history, achieve equal outcomes measured by mean statistics between groups of millions of individuals. And that this is a way, not only can we do this with policy, but we should, because that's what justice entails. Mm-hmm. It locates the locus of justice is the group in that view. That makes no sense to me because people do not suffer as groups. Even when they suffer because they're thinking about how their group is treated, the locus of suffering is the individual. So if you're a utilitarian or a consequentialist, if you base your sense of what is good and what is bad on the idea that reducing suffering for human beings and sentient creatures is what it means to be an ethical person, then you have to locate your ethical concern in individuals, not groups. And perversely, there's a zero-sum conflict between the individualist view and the group view, because I'll never forget the New York Times editorial from last summer, which talked about poor Asian families in New York, immigrant families that would, quote, scrimp on essentials like food to pay for test prep in order to get into the city's elite colleges, which discriminate against Asians in favor of blacks and Hispanics. So what you're talking about there is just a zero-sum conflict between two different conceptions of justice, one of which is happy to see the collateral damage of individual Asian families who are not favored in the group justice scheme. It's favoring a kind of abstract historical justice, which we're actually not omniscient or omnipotent enough to even successfully do. Over a kind of justice that is actually achievable by human beings with limited capacities, such as ourselves.
Switch topics. I think I'm switching topics here, but you are a jazz trombonist. What do you have a regular gig in New York Where is it and where can people see you play?
Almost every Monday at the Jazz Standard on East 27th mm-hmm. between Park and Lex.
And what kind of jazz do you play?
I play, it's with the Mingus, the Charles Mingus Big Band. Charles Mingus was very prominent jazz musician and composer, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And we play his music only, but he was very prolific. First African-American, I think, to have his music enshrined in the Library of Congress. Mm. So I play there virtually every Monday.
What do you like about Mingus's music? And I say this as a jazz tard. I know nothing about jazz and I don't like it, but I'm trying.
Yeah. Charles Mingus kind of sounds like Duke Ellington on acid.
Okay. That's like the acid part.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a start.
That's honest to God, the best description I can give. Any more detail would actually detract from the explanation.
Who are, besides Mingus, who are your jazz gods?
Oh, love Coltrane. Hmm. I love Duke Ellington. In terms of more modern people, I love Ben van Gelder. He's mm-hmm. a slightly obscure Dutch saxophonist who I think is brilliant. Ambrose Akinmusri is quite good.
Has jazz become something like opera or classical music where it seems like it's for a rarefied elite as opposed, because it used to be the popular music, right?
Yeah. I would say it is neither, it is definitely no longer the popular music. Mm-hmm. And there are segments of it that are moving towards the kind of opera culture where it's getting funded by wealthy donors rather than a kind of natural, rather than having a natural bottom-up demand for mm-hmm. it. There are segments of it, jazz at Lincoln Center, for example, that are going in that direction of a more of a museum piece.
Right.
But there's still a jazz scene, at mm-hmm. least in New York and some other, in Chicago, other parts of the country. There's an organic jazz scene that could not be said of opera.
Right. That's exciting to hear. Final question. What do you plan to do when you graduate college? I mean, because you realize you're peaking. I mean, I hate to be the one to tell you that, but like it's
all downhill from here.
I'm not going to say definitely, but I'd say there's a confidence interval there that's pretty high.
I don't know.
That's an excellent answer, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. We've talked about this. You've given me some good advice in this respect. I don't know. Yeah,
that's good. Well, we will continue to read your writings at Quillette and in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and elsewhere. National Review, I know you've had a couple of pieces in. We have been talking with Coleman Hughes. He is a columnist at Quillette and a prolific writer and one of the most interesting and original voices on race. So, Coleman, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I've been Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason, at Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts on. Thanks for listening.